Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive functions. This show is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. These conversations will introduce mental tools that will empower you to shift your mindset for a successful life. And now, here's your host, Sucheta Kamath.
All right, welcome back to Full Prefrontal, where we are exposing the mysteries of executive function. As always, I am here with our host, Sucheta Kamath. Good morning, my friend. Good to be with you. As always, I'm very much looking forward to your conversation today. Kick things off for us, please.
Well, good morning to you as well, Todd. And it's such a delight to be here. You know, I am obsessed with Henry Winkler. He's one of my favorite an actor, I guess not a comedian, but more like an actor. And recently I've been watching him in an HBO show called Barry, and he's just phenomenal. But recently I had a chance to hear him on Fresh Air and a couple of other places. And he came to our International Dyslexia Association of Georgia organized an event where he was a, you know, chief guest of honor. And he came and spoke about growing up with dyslexia and learning disability. And he talks about his parents who were, you know, Eastern European, I think, and referred to him as a dumb dog in German, you know, when he was growing up. He never received any support. He was quite often criticized for struggles that he had in learning, and he was often blamed for not thinking. And, you know, as I was listening to this, it just reminded me that the way we address thinking in general in the context of education, and that's why I'm so excited to speak to our guest today. But we often talk about thinking as if it's an effortless process, just as breathing is, and somehow it should be present without instructions. We often even tell students that, why don't you just think? But in fact, what we know from neuroscience, education, cognition, you know, cognitive psychology, I guess, is that thinking can be referred to with various names, including executive function or mindful reflection, you know, cognitive process, intelligence, even attention, reasoning, and finally, metacognition. So I wanted to kind of explore that today and also see how can we really prepare the next generation of young minds and provide them with all the tools for thinking. So that's why this wonderful speaker. So today we have Kathleen Kriza in the studio, I guess, and she's a lifelong learner, an experienced educator, and outstanding presenter. I personally have had a chance to hear her, so I can vouch for that. She's passionate, informed, and committed to bringing the best educational practices to educators and parents so that they can help all children to succeed. She is a co-author of a wonderful book, Transformative Teaching, Changing Classrooms Culturally, Emotionally, and Academically, which I think we have had, our listeners might remember, Marian Brittingham, who was our guest. She's the co-author with Marian. But Kathleen is also featured in a video, Differentiating Instruction in the Intermediate Grades, Bureau of Education and Research. In 2008, she has also done extensive training over the years with giants in the field on topics such as differentiated instruction, brain-based learning, cooperative learning, co-teaching, coaching, and content literacy. And a very special connection, which I recently discovered, that she is the better half of one of my favorite researchers, Jack Naglieri. So it's a great pleasure and an honor to have Kathleen on the podcast today. Welcome to the podcast, Kathleen.
Thank you, Sucheta. I am totally excited to be here to share with you things that I'm, as you said, very, very passionate about. So thank you for inviting me.
So let's jump into it. So how would you describe your own executive function? And as an educator who works with children, have you benefited from your insights into improving skills and managing self?
That's a big question to answer. But I would say that growing up, I was not taught anything about how my brain works and how thinking occurs. And I was a good student, so learning came easily to me. But when it got hard, I had no idea really how to manage studying and, you know, being prepared for my future. I was a first generation American, so I wasn't really taught how to go to college. And there's a lot of skills involved in becoming a college student that involve executive function. And so it was a really challenging, difficult experience for me compared to, I think, what I saw with the you know, my fellow students around me. So I think as I got into education, I started in my second year learning about the concept of metacognition and teaching students to think about their own thinking. And that was, I actually get goosebumps while I say it, because that was a huge change, not only for me personally, but in everything that I did as an educator from that point forward. And that was, you know, 30 years ago when I began that journey. So I know without a doubt in teaching this way, teaching in a metacognitive way, and helping kids understand how their brains learn, I wish I'd had that growing up. I wish I'd been able to give more of the brain research that we have out there to the students I worked with back then. But I do know that when I changed and shifted to teaching them about, to me, executive function and metacognition are two of the same. They're woven together. I've made a difference for kids. It's made a difference in my life to be aware of how my brain learns and the neuroplasticity that I, even though I age, I can still make changes in neural connections in my own brain. It's a lifelong process. So big impact on me personally and professionally.
Yeah. You know what? I think what's reverberating with me is that fundamentally you had a great sense of openness within. And to me, that's a sign of a strong executive function, being receptive, being open. And another thing that you said that struck a chord with me, that being a student, being a good student, particularly, I think you assume that thinking is going to continue to be effortless just the way it has been earlier. So not just because you are a good student doesn't mean you will know what to do when things get hard. So that brings me to my first question about helping all the listeners, as well as whether they're parents, educators, teachers, psychologists. But what do you think gets in the way of students developing their executive function?
Adults, whether they're parents or teachers, we have a tendency out of such a good place in our hearts to do too much of the thinking and the planning for students and children. And what we do when we take away their thinking and their planning, we become their prefrontal cortex. So we become their, you know, prefrontal cortex is where executive function unfolds. And when we become their prefrontal cortex, they aren't developing their own prefrontal cortex. So when I work with parents and teachers, I really want them to realize that when they take away kids' struggle, I think that's another big issue, is we tend to take away their struggle and their failure. And when we protect them too much, they don't learn from their mistakes. And we know in the neuroscience that mistake making, risk taking and mistake making, and then being able to figure out what you did wrong and what you should do differently next time actually grows stronger neural connections. I love the book Talent Code by Daniel Coyle. And he does a wonderful job of making the neuroscience about risk taking user friendly for us as parents and teachers. And in there, he talks about how when we make mistakes and we work through them, the myelin that wraps around those neural connections is actually stronger. So as adults, when we take away their struggle, what we're doing is we're sending the message that they aren't capable. So we want to let them fall off their bikes and fail that test and not rescue them every time something goes wrong, because then we're their prefrontal cortex and we've taken away take risks, make mistakes.
Yeah. And I think I love this book called Blessings of Skinned Knee. I don't know if you have ever read it.
I have.
It's a phenomenal book written by a psychologist in the Los Angeles area, as she serves these affluent families and their children. And one of the things that she talks very passionately about is the same exact thing, that our motivation is to protect and to seal and provide comfort to our children, but we are doing more harm than we know. And you're right. I think I haven't heard an educator talk so emphatically that what comes in the way of developing executive function is adults. So I love that framework. So let's elaborate that a little bit more. What kind of role do children's own ability of developing executive function, which is on a trajectory of slow and gradual incline, come in the way of keeping up with the demands on their executive function? So for example, a fourth grader is going to be more proficient than a seventh grader, but the instructional process maybe such that the fourth grader is expected to have certain level of proficiency, but he may not have it, and that can cost him, or that can become a big barrier in general success or even, you know, interpersonal relationship. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I think what you're asking me is about the developmental. Am I understanding that you're asking me about the development of executive function through the ages?
Exactly. So what I'm asking is that there's one element, which is the expectations and a lot of doing for children can come in the way, as you mentioned. And then the second component, which is there is actual delay in certain children's brains because of developmental challenges that can cause problems with their executive function. And yet we are expecting them to have certain executive function proficiency. So how do we understand that in the classroom setting when different children are developing at a different pace their executive function?
You know, students, like plants, all develop in different ways and at different times. And the idea that every child should be reading at the same time, or, you know, comprehending text or figuring out math problems, is just, we know that's not true. We know with the neuroscience that all brains develop differently and at different times. And that some brains, you know, come with struggles, with learning struggles that are different than the other kids. As a special education teacher, when I started teaching, I was a general education teacher. I taught English and I had 125 kids, and I didn't have any knowledge about how to work with kids that struggled, but I had them. And so I went back and got my special education training because I wanted to understand the brains of kids who learn differently. And so the more as educators we understand that kids that learn differently, whether it's, you know, cognitive development or learning disabilities or ADHD, the more we can support them in the classroom and not expect them to learn the same way that other students learn. So we need to understand that their executive function may develop more slowly. So they may need more repetition, or generally what they need is more, you know, modeling and scaffolding of the kind of skills that we want them to use in the classroom. It may be that they develop those skills a year later. I've always said I provide my special ed students with the tools that I know are good tools for becoming stronger in their thinking and executive function, but I might not be there to see when it pops.
I like that. Like you're tilling the soil, and you may not be there for the beautiful garden.
Right, right. But I've seen kids that, you know, I've had students that came back to speak to me, and I have some students that find me on Facebook now to say, you know, the greatest gift you gave us was to be a community of learners and a community of thinkers. And I think that's the gift we give all kids, and then we don't assume that they're going to get it in the same way at the same time. And when we create that kind of a, whether it's a home environment where you have one child that's has a challenge, or a school environment where we have them all, that we create that space where we say, it doesn't matter when you get it. It matters that we're all learning to develop our thinking, and we all can.
I think your approach and that you're describing it, I think it's a compassionate one, one that has a deep, you know, sense of neuroscience, but also some allowance made for that individual difference. I find often teachers who don't come from this school of thought tend to be quite annoyed with their children or students, and often feel that, you know, the student is intentionally being difficult, or is intentionally not, or is being defiant. So you're kind of inviting them to change their mindset a little bit.
Absolutely inviting them to change their mindset.
Talk a little bit about that. What does that look like in terms of education, where teachers themselves changing their mindset, as well as then, as a result, maybe teaching students to change their mindset?
In the workshops that I do and in the transformative teaching book, that is what I lead with. And that is the most important change. We almost called our book Making Those Kids Our Kids, because in the work that Marianne and I do across the field, and that Alicia, our co-author, do across the field, we hear that a lot. Why do I have to have those kids in my classroom? I didn't used to have those kids in my classroom. And, you know, I say to teachers, those kids are our kids. You don't get to pick who shows up in your classroom. And they all have beautiful brains, and they all have things to offer us. And the more we can see that, the more I believe, and from my experience as a teacher, that the kids that taught me to be a good teacher were the kids that came with the greatest challenges. You know, if I'd had all the teacher pleasers,
love that.
If I had all the teacher pleasers, I would have thought I was a great teacher. But I know now that those kids have a lot to offer. And those kids make a difference in how we understand the brain and what we can do to help all kids learn. Changing teachers' mindsets and teachers first begins with their desire. I think they need to have the awareness that their mindsets could be getting in the way. So we talk a lot about that in the work, that our mindsets impact kids' mindsets. And if we believe they can't learn or they can't grow or they can't change, then that's going to impact how kids feel how we feel about them, and they see how we feel about them. And if we're saying to ourselves, well, you came from that background, or you have this learning challenge, or you're from this cultural environment, we're projecting that out. And so we know that our mindsets make a difference. And we have to make the choice to really look at kids in a different way and to say to ourselves when they're challenging, wow, I've never had a kid like that. I can't wait to see what they're going to teach me this year about how to become a better teacher. And we have to.
Sounds like it's like a bringing the growth mindset into your own life before you bring it into your child's life.
Yes, it has to be us developing our growth mindsets along with our students. And that's a process. And it's something we have to catch ourselves at, because when we're having a difficult or challenging day as an educator or a school psychologist or a parent, you know, we can get into our fixed mindset mode. And we have to catch ourselves. I think we first, because we're the adults, need to be modeling how you get back into a growth mindset when you've stepped into a fixed mindset, and do that with the students. The teachers I work with all over the world work on mindsets with their students, not just at their students. And I think, you know, it's okay to say, hey, we're learning to do this together. We're in this together, developing our neural connections together. I make mistakes too, and that's okay. And my
I've talked to teachers and parents as well to share their mistakes. And one of the things that you mentioned really is an exercise that I encourage, I feel, which is telling the child that I failed because of my assumptions. I failed myself. And one thing that I have encouraged the teachers to say is last year, like, getting in front of the students and saying in the beginning of the year, let me tell you who was my most difficult student last year. And when you talk about that, if the teachers get the practice of talking about what made that student difficult for me, not what was about that student that made him difficult, I think can be an example of that mindset shift or demonstration or modeling you're talking about. Is that fair? Is that a good example?
Yeah, I'd never thought of that. But the shift to it is me, whether you say it at the beginning of the year or all year, you know, I've apologized to my students when I have handled things wrong with them and come back and said to a whole class, not just an individual student, that this was about me. It wasn't about you. It was, I made a mistake. I didn't handle this well. Let me have a redo. And that's such a powerful thing for them to realize that we take ownership of ourselves and our own growth and our own mistakes. We're setting a powerful message, and we're helping them understand that we're human and that we're growing as well, and that it's okay to have those discussions.
Love that. So let's talk about mindfulness practices. You often talk about that in your work and your presentations. How do you think these mindful practices support students' social emotional well-being in the classroom? And why are they so essential?
I think the research that we're finding on mindfulness practices is life-changing, again, for parents and teachers and psychologists and, of course, children. Something I wish I had been taught growing up. We're seeing so many anxious children. I would say one of the number one things, the two things I hear the most when I ask parents, teachers that I work with across the, again, around the world, what are your two biggest challenges? Number one relates to our first question, parents rescuing their children and not holding them to the natural consequences that they should face. So that goes back to question number one, but also anxious kids. And I'm talking about kindergarten and first grade and beyond. And I think there's a lot of reasons why we're seeing so many anxious children. A lot of it's, I believe, is screen time. If we look at the research, we're seeing that kids under two are spending 3 hours a day in front of screens versus less than half an hour in 1997. And you know, that's scary. And I think it increases anxiety because the messages are coming at them fast and furious, and they don't have that quiet time and that downtime. They witness way too much violence on television, things that parents would never allow them to see in their actual home. You know, they allow them to see on television, and you know, the teenagers are seeing the violent video games, and they're not getting outside enough. You know, they're not. I'd like to talk about that more in a bit, but they're that not running and not playing creates a lot of anxiety as well, and the pressure in schools, the high pressure of parents, especially of parents in high performing communities, to be perfect, to always be the best, to always get into the best colleges, to you're the smartest kid ever, and you have to be smart all the time. All of that promotes anxiety in our children. And I think it's a national problem. The solution, or one of the solutions to that, before you get to medications, unless it's really extreme, to me is the mindfulness practices. And what we're seeing is that mindfulness practices done on a consistent basis with children is increasing their learning, and it's decreasing their anxiety. And of course, when their anxiety is less, they're more able to learn, because anxiety, for those of us who experience it, and this is something I'm passionate about because I'm a high anxiety person, is that it helps you think and learn more effectively. And when we look at Sharon Salzberg's work, she's an expert in the field.
Yeah.
You know Sharon? Yeah,
she's I know her work and I love it. I've attended her workshops and I do have a mindfulness practice myself. I love it.
Yeah, she's powerful. And she did 8 weeks of mindfulness practices with 4th through 6th graders. And when she looked at the research, again, she saw the decrease in anxiety and improved attention, really important for our ADD, ADHD kids, less emotional reactivity, which is, you know, many types of our students, and more acceptance of themselves, you know, which is so healing and healthy. And so we know, and that's just some of the research. You know, Goldie Hahn's project from Minds Up has a lot of research in the work that they've been doing on mindfulness in the classrooms. So again, that's a practice. What I love about practicing mindfulness with students or your own children is that when you practice it with them, you get to do it yourself. So it's another skill. I think, you know, the most powerful skills for building executive function and calming the brain are good for adults as well as they are students, and equally as important. So, you know, we want to look at simple, doable ways to build mindfulness practices into our lives, to heal ourselves as well as our classrooms, and to heal our students and help them to find ways to calm. And we're really seeing benefits of that in both the inner city schools. They're doing work on that in Baltimore schools and seeing a reduction in suspensions. But I think it's equally important for the students of, you know, very high-powered, high-pressured schools that I work in.
You know, I think what I'm hearing you speak about is this idea that the most important thing, I think, is not getting addressed in everyday education is teaching children to come from a place where there's greater acceptance of self. I think this notion of a perfect learner to me is a myth, because by definition, learning means you don't know. So then I often find that the children are put in a place where they come with this mindset that I should have already known. And then I don't understand, how would you know something that you're about to learn? And you're learning because you did not know. So if you have that self-acceptance that not everything that you don't know is because you are having a difficulty, but it is because the nature of the job of being a student can be extremely healthy and healing, as you mentioned. So I love that, what you're saying. Tell me a little bit about, how do you think, what are the doable ways that teachers and parents can promote children being in charge of their learning lives or in their social emotional lives? I think it's a fascinating topic.
Well, I'd love to give you what I call the winning formula for success in school and in life and socially and emotionally. And then I'd also like to give you some really pragmatic practices that you can do. with your children in the classroom. The formula that I teach in all the work that I do is that mindsets plus skill sets equal results. And I think, let me explain that, but I think it's really essential that we teach children and that we understand how brains develop and how they learn to think and how they learn to learn. And that I'll tell you more. So let's look at the mindset part, you know, from Carol Dweck's and other researchers' work. And we know that if we don't have growth mindsets, if we're saying negative things to ourselves, if we're saying we can't do this, that your thoughts actually sculpt your brain. So the more that you program your brain to say, I can't, I can't, I can't, I won't, you know, the resistance as well, and for adults and teachers, the more you're bombarding your cells with those negative thoughts, that's how they're going to wire together. You know, what I teach my teachers and students is that neurons that fire together, wire together. So if what you're wiring in the brain are negative thoughts, that's going to be what your life view, what you create, that negativity bias. But if you practice positive thoughts, if you practice gratitude on a regular basis, if you say, I know that this is a risk-taking, mistake-making process, this thinking and learning thing, but I can do it. We'll get to the skill set part in a moment, but if we can continue to practice, again, it's a daily lifetime practice, you can reprogram those pessimistic cells into positive cells, and the wiring changes. So over time, it does become easier. It does become more effective. And I get so excited in the schools I work in. I'm working in a school in Barrie, Vermont, with preschool through middle school teachers, where we're teaching them to teach kids about this. And one of the things we get so excited about is, imagine starting in preschool and kindergarten that you were learning to develop a positive mindset and to build and to understand what a mindset is, fixed versus growth, and build those neural connections all the way through. I mean, wouldn't you have loved to have something like that in your ongoing education, besides learning math and besides learning, facts?
I would love to. I grew up in India, and there's, of course, the good, bad, and the ugly of any educational system anywhere in the world. And so one thing that I got, which I was very, very grateful for, was incredible nudge to do deep thinking and writing. And it was systematically taught and supervised. But there was also the downside of humiliation was not at all spared. I grew up in schools where your scores were displayed on the doorway into the classroom. Oh, so my. Everybody with your name. Thankfully, I was always the topper. But that doesn't mean that I was not, I too was insecure about falling from grace if I came second. But I cannot even imagine those who were struggling and genuinely struggling because they had some difficulties and their names being displayed in the bottom with red if they were failing, how much disastrous that method was, even though I can see it can benefit in some ways to develop awareness, but not such a harsh reality awareness without any support.
cruel and unusual punishment. And I think even for the students at the top, I worked with gifted children for many years. And of course, my husband does a lot of work with gifted children. And when they are expected to be smart and be at the top of the list all the time, that is a phenomenal pressure for their mindset. And gifted kids often have the most fixed mindsets because everyone's telling them, you're so smart, you're so smart, you're so smart. They feel like they have to do that all the time. And I have a best friend who's a high school counselor. And she said, you can't believe how many gifted kids come down to me and say, if one more person tells me you're so smart, I'm going to kill myself. And they're not joking. They're hurting because the pressure to be number one is, then when you fail, you're not number one. And for those students at the that are struggling because of whatever learning problems or social emotional problems, I mean, we have kids that have traumatic things going on in their homes. You can't learn under those conditions. Helping them both ends of that spectrum to know that they can reprogram their brain and that every thought in their brain releases a chemical and that they can shift their thoughts, that it's about how you think, not about your grades and your points and your scores. I mean, all of that creates fixed mindset thinking in our schools. It's a big problem in our schools. And I will have to say, and I say this with great love, parents, you are the worst offenders.
Yes.
Parents are so obsessed with grades and points and scores that they've lost sight of the fact that we should want children to be lifelong learners and lovers of learning. And that in that process, mistake making and not being perfect is critical. I mean, it's essential. I'm working with a teacher now. She's a special ed teacher in Barrie, Vermont. I was just there a few weeks ago, and she did the most amazing thing. She's working with kids in their second graders, the group I was with. She did it with all of her students. But these are kids who can't not read. And they are super struggling with reading. It's painful. There's only three of them that she works with. It's a, you know, close intervention. And they don't believe in themselves. They don't believe that they can learn to read. Already by second grade, their self-perception and their self-compassion is so low and so difficult. And as I've been teaching her, and she's been super growth mindset herself about trying these things, you know, she only sees them for a half an hour. And she's like, I felt like I didn't have time to talk about mindsets with them and about how their brains change and learn. But now I know I would never not do that, because it has been the door opener for these kids starting to be willing to learn skill sets, which is the second part of that equation that I want to get to. But she had them while I was there draw pictures of the critical critters that were in them that said all these mean and nasty things. And the kids named their critical critters. I think one was like Loser Lisa. These are second graders. And they had a vision of that monster within them that says all these nasty things. And then, so we talked about that. I was there and we talked about how you can change that, how you can, that you don't have to be that way, because that's a nasty critter that you can ask to leave your brain. And then the next day, I wasn't there, but she did the growth mindset superheroes. So they drew another picture. So those visuals are powerful. Another picture of what that superhero can come in and help you do to develop your mindsets and your skill sets. I mean, that's powerful.
So powerful. And I can even imagine this being a lifestyle, not just in teaching, but even raising children, but even as workplace. Can you imagine the critical critters at workplace and then growth mindset, he superheroes at workplace? So I see this being really infiltrating our lives, all aspects of our lives. Beautiful example, Kathleen. So as we come to the end of this discussion, I wanted to not leave you without talking about metacognition. And you and I share great interest in this topic. You and I have a great commitment to helping children develop these proficiencies of self-monitoring, self-assessment, and self-talk. Do you mind talking a little bit about that?
And that is metacognition. Metacognition is the second part of the equation. Mindsets plus skill sets equal results.
Yes.
So you can have a growth mindset, but if you haven't developed metacognitive skill sets, you're still going to be, you know, stuck as a learner. So what we know about the brain again today is that it can develop neural connections by practicing self-reflective strategies about their social emotional selves as well as their academic selves. And that when we teach in metacognitive ways with our students and our children, that they do better in school, they do better in life. So instead of telling them things to do and telling them how to do things, we want to get in the habit of asking them, which is a change for us. It's easy to tell them how to tie their shoe, and now we buy them Velcro shoes or we tie their shoes for them. We know that if we want them to be self-sufficient, we need to show them how and then let them practice. And then if they make a mistake in school, if they don't pass the test, you know, for kids along the grade levels, we have them self-analyze, self-reflect. I have my kids do exit cards. You know, what did I do to study for that test? Did it work or not work? What would I do differently next time? You know, that's teaching them to think about their own thinking and recognize that they can develop a skill set of more effective strategies to help them along the way. For my special education students, that was the key, the door opener, to realize that thinking and learning didn't happen magically. You know, it happened by developing these skill sets. And for my struggling learners, I need to do a lot more modeling and scaffolding. You know, their brains don't always come to those strategies magically. So we want to, you know, do a lot of practices with them and really teach them about their brains. You know, I teach them about their prefrontal cortex and how that's the place where they plan and where they come up with effective strategies, and that they can build a toolkit of strategies over time, and that using those strategies effectively can help them be effective in life with their friends, with their academics. So I just have to tell a fun story. I've been teaching my granddaughter about that. And she came downstairs. She was spending the night with us, and she came downstairs. She's seven. And she said, you know, when I was getting dressed today, I realized that I didn't have the capris I wanted to wear because I'm going in the water. But I used my prefrontal cortex. I came up with a plan to hike up my pants so that I would be able to go in the water. And I see that with the teachers that are being very intentional and very transparent about teaching kids that plans are built in the prefrontal cortex, and that when you think about your own thinking and you get stuck, you don't quit, you come up with a plan. Could I ask for help? What should I do differently? Can I look in the book? Can I ask a friend, phone a friend, so that they have a plan? I teach them, and I'm hitting my hand on my forehead. I teach them, duh, I need a plan. And that they need to think smart. They need to stop and think. They need to make a plan. They need to take action. They need to review to see if that plan is working, and then either try again if it's not working, or ta-da, I got it. And that intentional teaching of metacognitive skills, endlessly, practice, 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 helps kids to shape their brains and help them love learning as well.
Love it. Love it. You are so such a wonderful educator, Kathleen. I love your ideas, love the way you present them and make them palatable. As we come to an end, I want to ask you, what are we as a society doing right? So what are you very optimistic about the way we are teaching these skills, and how well is this formula working, which is mindset plus skill set lead to results? And what are your worries about the world, because these skills take time and because some may know about it, some may not know about it? So do you have any closing thoughts about that?
Well, I'll start with the worries and end on the happy note.
I'm glad you changed the order. That's what I meant. Yes.
My worries are that, you know, educators and psychologists and parents are not getting this information enough. I think wish they were being bombarded with it. So I'm glad for your podcast and the fabulous people that are bringing the neuroscience to us. I think that teachers need to understand that it starts with them and them shaping their mindsets and their skill sets. And I worry when there's an unwillingness to do that. When I do the work that I do with educators around the world, I worry that kids get the wrong messages from us about learning, and even things that they see, you know, on television that, you know, make everybody look perfect. Television and the media make it seem like everybody's perfect and that things come easily. So you've heard me talk about screen time. I would get them off screen time and out playing and making mistakes and stumbling and fumbling and bumbling and working things out together instead of us fixing things for them when they have, you know, social emotional challenges. My hope, and I do think the formula mindsets plus skill sets equals results, is the formula for hope, because we know with the neuroscience that when we shape our mindsets and when we develop metacognitive skill sets, when you look at the research from Dweck, when you look at the research from, you know, my husband, Jack, excuse me, Naglieri, and from so many others in the field of neuroscience today, that when you do those things, you do see results. You see academic performance increase. You see social emotional challenges decrease. And I think that the more we do that, the more we can change the world in positive ways. And the more the children that are raised that way will go out and create a better world for us. That's my passion. That's why I'm out doing what I do.
And love you for it. Thank you for what you do. And truly, I love this idea about the formula is not only effective, but it's a formula for hope. And I am so glad that, you know, a few educators have been as emphatic and clear as you have been that, you know, the change begins with the teachers. And I know, unfortunately, the teachers, there's a lot riding on them, but they feel they need to produce good results in their teaching. But instead, if they focus on being that educator who brings this mindset, the automatic impact of that would be that their students will learn no matter how their learning is challenging or not. And I think your message comes out very loud and clear. So I cannot thank you enough for being a guest today and being so generous and thoughtful and truly leaving a legacy of your work through books, which I will share in the links in my podcast. It was a total joy to have you on the podcast, Kathleen. Thank you.
It was a total joy to be invited. And thank you for all that you're doing to spread the word, because your work is very, very important. And I'm grateful for what you're doing. Thank you.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. If you know of someone who just might benefit from listening to today's episode, we would be most grateful if you would kindly forward it to them. So on behalf of our host, Sucheta Kamath, today's guest, Kathleen Kriza, and all of us at Cerebral Matters, thanks for listening today, and we look forward to seeing you again right here next week on Full Prefrontal.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive functions. To contact our host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive functions, visit her website at CerebralMatters.com. That's CerebralMatters.com. Tune in next week for the next informative episode of Full Prefrontal.